As a quarterback, I love sports. But sometimes when I get hit on my blind side, front side, and put on my backside, I wonder, is Sport Clips better than sports? Because Sport Clips haircuts is sports on TV, plus a relaxing haircut, hot steam towel, and massaging shampoo, which is better than sports plus Sport Clips. It's a game changer. Check in online at sportclips.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Patterson back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before we get to my amazing guest this week, I want to direct everybody to my updated website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. On there, what you'll find is my tab on going to Everest this next year. It's going to be an amazing journey. My trip to Mount Everest to climb it was not canceled. It was postponed. I'm now leaving March 31st, 2021. I'm also have now partnered with a new organization called Higher Ground. It's really an amazing organization. Jason, you're going to like this. It's helping not exclusively, but majority of veterans who are dealing with PTSD, amputation, things like that. So my daughter has epilepsy. We're trying to raise $27,940, which represents the height of Lhotse, which is the fourth highest mountain in the world. My goal, of course, is to climb Mount Everest and then also take on Lhotse all in kind of one swoop. And so that will be a big challenge, but also it's a challenge for all those out there that are afflicted with this disease. So I'm excited to start to partner with that organization. And of course, you can find all my podcasts. I've done over 160 of these now on my website, including iTunes, Stitcher, and many other places. But as always, I would so appreciate a ratings and review if you would. It's not about me being popular. It's about having more exposure. And on iTunes, it's all about more ratings and review, the more exposure it gets. Okay. So talking about exposure, let's jump into my guest today. He's a wonderful guy. I've been on his show. His name is Jason Piccolo. Jason, how you doing?
I'm doing great. And I was just going to say it's now $27,800 because on behalf of the protectors, we will be donating $100 to the cause. And anybody who matches my donation, up to 20 people will also get patches and a free signed book of my unwavering your border agent's journey. So there we go.
I love that. Thank you so much. That means so much to me. You know, actually, it's I was just made aware of this, that I just formed this partnership with Higher Ground, and some mysterious person had thrown in $2,000 out of the gate. So we're actually $2,000 less. So we're actually now down to $25,940 minus your, I think, $100 contribution. So, you know, it all counts. It all matters. And thank you very much. Yeah. And so when I started doing research on you, Jason, the thing that I can say, I've had a few different military people on, but I haven't had like an actual Jack Ryan on the show, you know, to date. And I was just like, man, this guy has, I'm sure, has seen just more crazy stuff. I've seen, you know, these shows on Narcos and the different drug lords to people trying to come across the border. And you've got this really fascinating life that goes back quite a few years, over 20 years, working in law enforcement, but really protecting the border down along the San Diego and the Mexican line. And I'd love just to hear kind of your words more about what life was like. And then we'll jump into other things. I've got other questions that follow within that, but it just seems so fascinating to me. It's just a constant cat and mouse.
It is absolutely cat and mouse. That is the southern border. And I always tell people it's like the Wild West. It really is. It's so lawless. It's bloody. And by bloody, I mean, when I first started out as a Border Patrol agent in January 2000, so over 20 years ago now, when I first got to the border, I was like, this is really the United States? It felt like I was in some weird, like, quasi movie where these banditos are down in valleys, you know, raping and pillaging people that are trying to cross the border. And when you figure out that it's a reality and you have to live this day in and day out, you're kind of like, wow, what did I get myself into? You know, I'm a kid from New Jersey, and the closest I came to California was spring break once.
It's crazy. So help me understand better then the path that if somebody wants to become a border agent and you're coming from New Jersey, right? And you've got New York as one of your borders, that you're actually going to be lured into this. Was it a movie? Was it a TV show? Was it an influence from one of your buddies? How did that all play out?
No, this is actually, I just brought this up the other day, and it's a really weird time for me right now, because I got into it because of my best friend I met. I was in the Army in the 1990s. You know, my goal in life was always to be a soldier, and then it was to become a police officer. And then one of my best friends became a Border Patrol agent when we were living out in Texas. And I'm like, what is a Border Patrol agent? He goes, hey, you should apply, bro. It's a federal job. And they'll take your military, and your military will kind of turn you, it will attack onto your retirement. So the years I did in service will go on to my retirement. So I figured, hey, you know, I could do 20 years in law enforcement, tack on my military time, and boom, great for retirement. Well, my buddy Chris goes out to San Diego and becomes a Border Patrol agent. And I eventually, after college, so I get out of the Army, I go to college, get a degree in law enforcement. I get stationed at the same exact station as my best friend, Chris. And he taught me the ropes, and that's how I got into it. But the reason I bring up Chris is because Chris died in the line of duty 2 years ago, you know, after he had his 20 plus years in. And kind of having that mentor and having someone that did that job and got me into law enforcement and knowing that you can actually die in the line of duty, it's crazy, man. It's not a pleasant way to, like, you know that you're mortal, if that makes a sense.
So obviously that'd be a devastating loss. There's your mentor, there's your buddy, the guy that touched the ropes, showed you what to do, how to do it. I'm sure there was multiple adventures that you guys are in the same car. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now it's, you know, chase and track and arrest, yeah, and all those things. Right. Tell me, I want to get into the danger zone, and I want to separate it between San Diego and Mexico and Texas and Mexico, because I've heard down along out of, I guess it's out of El Paso, the town that's right across there on the Mexican side is dangerous as it can be. It is literally, yeah, the Wild West, even more so than what you were just describing down on the California. So let's start with California first and break, sure, that down, and then let's transition over to, I think it's Juarez.
Yeah, Juarez. That's, geez, man, it's like a combat zone there. It's probably like Baghdad Light or Mosul or something like that. But the problem is I was in a Border Patrol for 2.5 years, and then I became a special agent with the former U.S. Customs. And when I became a special agent, you know, I changed over to a different branch of the government. Customs eventually becomes ICE, Homeland Security Investigations. But back then, anything that had an international nexus to it, anything that crossed the border, we would investigate, i.e. narcotics. So when I first became a special agent, I did that for a couple months, just working regular. Hey, you know, we got a car at the border. It's got narcotics in it, blah, blah, blah. Then I was assigned to what they call proactive groups, where we were assigned to go after, you know, the top tier smuggling organizations that were working down in Mexico and the United States. That's really when I got an eye-opening of the narco world. Everything, there is so much narcotics and illicit goods coming through that southwest border that you have no, you just can't possibly measure it. Because look at it this way. Each week, we would seize, just in San Diego alone, maybe 20, 30,000 pounds of weed, marijuana. And if we were lucky, we were getting 200 to 300 kilos of cocaine, if we were lucky. And that's throughout the whole San Diego sector. Now think about it. That's one of the busiest ports in the United States, one of the busiest ports in the whole world. And all this narcotics is coming through it. And I always tell people, supply and demand is, think about every small town in the United States, someone has cocaine, someone has marijuana, someone has meth. How much supply do you need to get through that border to supply every small town in the United States? So that's what we're up against. And everybody seemed was involved with it. And it becomes their way of life. And I can't fault them. You know, I mean, they don't look at the war on drugs like we look on the war on drugs. And I'm talking about like the mules and everybody else that are being used to smuggle the drugs across the border. They look at it as like, hey, you know what? I can make an easy $2,000 to bring a load across the border, or I could work for 6 months. I have a family, etc. So it still goes on to this day. And how do I know that? Is because 4 years ago, I was working for the White House Security Council's human smuggling cell. So I had a grasp of what was going on still at the border. I've written books about it. I keep in contact with everybody else. And nothing has changed. Nothing. If you ever do watch the shows Narco and everything else, you know that a lot of it is based in nonfiction with a big fiction spot to it. But it shows you how the influx from the 1980s and the 1990s went from marijuana pumping up through our southwest border to the hard drugs, to the cocaine, to the meth, and the violence came with it.
A lot of stakes, high stakes, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about the creative ways on how that happens, right? So now we're and I want to come back to human smuggling, you know, trying to get people into the United States, right? And I want to come back to that, but as it relates to drugs, is the idea is just throw as much stuff against the wall, knowing that some will stick and some will get caught. Is that the whole idea?
Well, you look at it this way. Canines, and this is open source stuff. This is stuff that you could read on a newspaper and everything else like that. Canines hit on odor. Marijuana has a ton of odor to it. So if you only have a finite amount of canines at the border, and then a cartel organization just flushes a whole bunch of cars with 40 or 60 keys of marijuana in them, and you end up putting your resources to seize them and to investigate them, what's coming behind those cars?
Yeah.
So, you know, your first wave will be marijuana. They know they're going to get picked up. Those people are going to go to jail. And the cars behind them have, you know, anywhere from, you know, 8 to 20 kilos of cocaine in them. And that is the ones it's really tough to find out unless you have human sources. And so everything kind of equates down to sources as well. Because in order to get, I mean, you're really one car out of how many hundreds of thousands of cars across that border is loaded. How to find them? You have to have sources.
Tell me the most creative way that you've ever seen. So, you know, obviously just kind of a straight over tackle might be somebody driving a car and they stuff in the tire, spare tire or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I know I've read over my life, you know, over time where there's been like, I'm making this up, but 3 miles of tunnels, right? Where it starts off at this guy's gas station, goes under the roof, you know, goes under the bathroom and then goes down. It's very sophisticated, right? Have you experienced that? Have you been in those tunnels?
And
what has blown your mind about what you've seen?
Now, I've been in rudimentary tunnels and I actually had to crawl through them myself in order to document it. And one funny story was they wanted someone to crawl through one of these tunnels to the other side and take pictures. Now, we were working with the Mexican Federales and I ended up crawling through and I popped up on the other side. And there's all these federales there. And I was just like, hola. Then I handed my camera and they started taking pictures of me in the tunnel and everything.
No, is this tunnel such that if you had to turn around, you could turn around?
No, not that one. But there are tunnels and I didn't work it directly because I was part of the tunnel task force at one time as well. But in between my career, I ended up getting recalled and sent to war. But right after I got sent, you know, my partners found a complex tunnel system. It was like, 30, 40 meters under the ground, had railroad tracks on it, electricity from one warehouse on one side of the border to the other one. And you could shuffle as much as you want through that tunnel day in, day out, 24/7. That is where, you know, the main narcotics tunnels and the main flows are going is through these tunnels.
Crazy. And who was the main drug king at that time? Are they coming out of Mexico, or is the ultimate trail going back to Colombia?
Well, Colombia for the cocaine. But back then it was Arellano Felix's organization. And later on, you know, the leaderships have changed multiple times over. Now you have different sects, you have different areas. And each time you go through the border, you know, there's different areas and you have to pay different people. So it's interesting times. It's a dangerous area, but the thing is, just stick to yourself. You know, don't go and say, if that makes any sense, you just kind of have to be careful. That's what I try to tell. Err on a side of caution.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with the Southwest border.
Well, I bet. Okay. So now let's compare that to the El Paso Juarez border. Essentially, they're trying to do the same thing, right? But it's just 10x more violent. So I hear. I've never been there. And why is that? Why is it more violent there than it is on the Mexican side, on the San Diego side?
Well, San Diego's more commercial. You know, you have the humongous factories and everything else that has to transit that border. And my theory is that you have somewhere like a Juarez that you have to rule with more of an iron fist in order to keep control, in order to keep those traffic portals open. Because, you know, anything that comes through the border is a commodity, whether that's a human narcotics, whether it's money going back down south. Because that's the other thing you have to look at, too, is all these proceeds don't go through legitimate channels. You have actual paper cash that is flowing back down south. And then you tack onto that where now we have arms and everything else that are going back down south, which has been going on for, you know, 2-3 decades as well. Contraband north, money and arms south.
Yeah, crazy. Not to put or devalue a human life, but in terms of just, I don't know if enjoyment, I'm not sure what the right word is, but what you thrived in better, did you like it more on the narco side, or did you enjoy it more on the human trafficking, people trying to bust through the border and try to get to the other side?
I really enjoyed working narcotics, because when I was doing that, I used to love putting the puzzle together, whether that was, you know, hey, I got a bad guy's phone number, I have an email, I have something I could track. That all brings me to other people within that networking. And I love finding out who's involved. I love putting together the puzzle, and I love going after complex organizations. Nowadays, I like the human trafficking. Granted, I'm outside of Homeland Security now, but my writing is I like to shine light on human trafficking, because it's a human we're dealing with now. But working, adventure, adrenaline is definitely narcotics.
A few years ago, it seemed like the number one campaign cry on behalf of Trump was to build this wall, right? And so I saw a couple shows, and they were showing like the reason why we need a wall. In some places, there's no friction at all. In other places, you know, they've got high walls. But at the end of the day, if somebody wants to get through, they can get through. So two questions. One is, do you share the same opinion? There is holes all over the place where you can get through. And number two, do you believe in this concept about trying to build a wall? Will that work?
A wall covering the whole entire border will not work, because you need areas to funnel the traffic through. Now, you could put up partial walls. And, you know, I was an infantry officer one time, and one thing I know how to do is funnel, is to set up your resources in certain areas to catch activity. Now, think about the Southwest border this way. If you're familiar with the East Coast, you have Route 95 that travels all the way from Maine to Miami. That is the size of our Southwest border. Think about if you took Route 95 and you put a wall going down that whole thing, 30 to 40 meters high, 10, 15 meters below ground. Well, natural resources and everything else, it's not feasible. But
what you mean is because there's a big rock formation, or there's a mountain, or something like that. Okay.
Natural stuff like that. And we do have natural barriers there already. Now, take for instance, I detailed out to Arizona once, And Arizona was just, I've never seen anything like it. There's a strand of wire out there. That's your border. The night comes, everything and its brother comes across the border. Park Ranger was killed right after I left there. Brian Terry, a Border Patrol agent, was killed. So many people killed there, and civilians as well. But let's say you take border wall and technology and you put a wall up. Okay, so let's say you put 20 miles of wall up. You leave a gap in the middle of it. In that gap, you could focus technology. You could focus resources. There are 16,000 Border Patrol agents for the whole Southwest border. That includes leadership. And that's a 24/7, 365-day operation to cover, you know, roughly, what, 1,954 to 2,000 miles? There's just simply not enough manpower. You know, and by manpower, I mean men and women to cover that area. So if you put up border walls in certain areas, you could funnel traffic, and then you could also put your technology up. You could put up your drones. You could put up your sensors. You could put your infrared and thermal scopes up, and then you could direct your resources.
Did you ever end up where you're in a place like Arizona and you've got this thin wire and basically anybody can walk back and forth all they want and they're all carrying heat, you know, and so you guys are out there and they're trying to dodge you, but it's inevitable that there's going to be conflict, right? And where you're in a situation which, you know, things got super intense and it is guns are drawn or you get into a firefight. Did you end up in situations like that?
I've gotten in a lot of tense situations on the Border Patrol and in a narco world. And it all depends on what your presence is like. You know, it's always keep a presence of mind. Don't get tunnel vision. And by tunnel vision, you know what it's like. You've played ball. You get that vision where you only see the end zone. It's the same way in law enforcement. You only see the one objective. You don't see what's going on around you. Don't get the tunnel vision and don't let your adrenaline overwhelm you to where your breathing's labored and you can't get into it, because that shows whoever you're encountering that you're fearful. It's the same way in the civilian world as well. If you're getting in some sort of conflict and you show that you're fearful, someone's going to take advantage of that. Same way in the sports world as well.
For sure. Absolutely. So this is kind of a stupid question, but also coming from a question who's a civilian that doesn't deal with the border and narcos and all that stuff. But so now you guys make a big bust, right? And, you know, whatever kind of drug you know, it didn't matter. But now you're sitting, you know, where the cops or the FBI or the border trade, whoever that is sitting and they've got a couple pallets full of marijuana or something. What do you do with it?
Like, oh my God. I would rather get cocaine just because. So I was part of I used to work a lot of operations. We used to have an undercover tractor trailer company, and we sometimes we get like 19,000-20,000 pounds of weed, marijuana, and you have to unload it and you have to weigh it and you have to package it. And I found out that I'm allergic to whatever they package it, because I'm always breaking out whenever I do it. So you get these like a tractor trailer full of marijuana is a lot that you, and you only have, let's say you have 10 agents that have to unload it, weigh it, maybe have to weigh it again and get a wrong count. It's a pain in the ass. And then after that, so it all goes to a huge warehouse and then eventually gets incinerated.
Yeah. Why not just incinerate it right out of the gate?
Oh, you can't. You need like,
you just know, the process.
It's, you need real incinerators, because we're talking tons and tons and tons of illegal narcotics. It's a lot, man.
So you shift, you'd mentioned this earlier, and I want to follow up on that. You shifted over to a White House Security Council, right? So does that mean you actually were going to the White House in Washington,
no.
D.C.?
Well, I have a, you know, there's a little bit in my, I don't really... There's a big gap in my career to where, so I was in the Army and I became an officer eventually, an infantry officer. And I got recalled and I was sent to Fort Benning, Georgia. And then I was sent to Mississippi in the summer of 2005.
Yeah.
Just in time for Hurricane Katrina. So I was in Katrina and then I deployed to Kuwait for a couple months. And then I forward deployed up to Iraq where I was attached to the Special Operations Command as their anti-terrorism officer. While all this is going on, my wife becomes an FBI agent. Because she was in the Army too at one time, law degree and all that other good stuff. And she gets stationed in Philadelphia. So when I get back from the war, I end up getting a job in Washington, D.C. to be closer because I wasn't able to transfer with my agency. And when I worked in Washington, D.C., I actually worked for the what they call the Criminal Investigation Task Force. So I used to do investigations on the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, i.e. Al-Qaeda. So I did that for a while, and I eventually was able to pick up a job in Philadelphia with DOD. And then I went and got a job with ICE, and then I worked fugitive operations for a while. I ran the state of Delaware doing fugitive operations, and then I got stationed in D.C., and then a couple of years later, I went to work for what they call the White House Security Council's human smuggling cell. And I actually worked north of the city. Was it west?
So going back on a little detail that you just threw out there, that, okay, so you were interrogating Guantanamo Bay Al-Qaeda imprisoned terrorist, right?
And so I'll just say that I worked, I can't really, there's like NDAs and all that other stuff. Yeah. I'll just say I typically conducted investigations on the detainees at Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah.
But I was stationed in Washington, D.C.
You know, I'm really glad that we're doing this. Where are you in California? Where are you at?
I'm in D.C.
So you're in D.C. and your code name is something like Lizard, or this is going to come full circle, man.
No, it's fun. I love talking about it, man.
Cool.
Because it was a different world for me. You know, I got a taste of terrorism when I was in, what do you call it, Iraq. So I was in Iraq, and I get assigned to the Combined Joint Special Operations Task Force. And they put me in charge of all their anti-terrorism force protection measures for all of the special operations forces on the, regular Green Berets and Navy SEALs and everybody else like that. Because, you know, on the other side, you have Dev Group and you have Delta and everybody else. So I was in charge of that for those guys. And while I was doing that, I found out a lot about terrorist organizations.
Yep. That is incredible. I want to ask you about your time in Iraq. What was that like for you? Everybody's got a different experience.
It was different for me because I was out of the military mindset for years at this time. I was in what they call the individual ready reserves. And as an officer, you can get recalled anytime. And I always thought my wife would get recalled before I was because she was military intelligence and I was just an infantry guy. But it was different because I am working these major narcotic cells, you know, working as much as I possibly could to put these guys in jail. And then all of a sudden I'm back in a uniform. I'm no longer Special Agent Piccolo. I'm Captain Piccolo and I'm in Iraq and I'm sitting behind a desk and all these like really cool special forces operations are going on. And it's just a different world, but it gave me a great concept of dynamic operations and how everything melds in together and how the military and law enforcement, the way they do operations and planning and operations can all kind of fit in together. And that also transfers into the civilian world. So every leader that has a military background knows exactly what they're getting into because it's all the basic leadership tenets are a military decision-making process 101, if that makes sense. So I do the war, I come back, and it took me a little while to get back into the civilian mindset, I can tell you that.
What is the difference between Kuwait, and I'm talking about from an American standpoint, right? So, you know, wherever you live, LA, San Francisco, New York, New Jersey, DC, you know, Austin, I mean, it didn't matter where you live, but we're used to a certain standard. You know, mm-hmm. You've actually have cement on the streets with lines down the middle and stoplights. And, you know, there's a process to the way our system works. Tell me the difference between Kuwait and Kuwait City and Iraq. And, you know, if you were somebody who'd never been over there, what you're stepping into?
Let's see. Kuwait would be like going to Austin and just going to a really nice street. Iraq would be like going to one of the deadliest areas, Chicago, on a weekend. Depends. If you're a U.S. soldier and you end up in the wrong place, you could be killed and tortured and maimed in Iraq. In Kuwait, it's not as likely.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you're walking through, you're driving through the town, I'm speaking really more about Iraq, Baghdad. Is it still pretty trash from all the bombing that we did years ago?
I don't know, because the last time I was there was in 2006. Yeah. So I don't know what it's like now. I can't even imagine, especially with ISIS.
Crazy group, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a whole nother level, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It all comes down to power. Everybody wants power.
So you've done a couple, I don't know how you've had time to do, you know, actually sit down and write a book, you know, when you're out there chasing all these guys and trying to, you know, put an end to it at some level. But tell me about these two books you've written and how to, I'm still trying to get one off the ground and you've, you know, had the good fortune of getting, got two.
Well, there's a reason I wrote a book. And if you ever Google my name, you'll come up with a few things. You'll either come up on my podcast, come up with some other stuff, but one of them will say Jason Piccolo whistleblower. So that is, I had to eventually leave, what do you call it? DHS, Department of Homeland Security, because I blew the whistle back in 2015. And hence, I wanted to get my story out there. And I want to.
What does that mean? You blew the whistle. What is that?
Well, I'll go into this. We have time. So I was assigned to the White House Security Council's human smuggling cell. And the reason they developed this cell was in 2012, 2013, there was a major influx of unaccompanied alien children, UACs, coming through the southwest border. Now, these are little kids. They could be tender-age kids. They could be kids in their teens. But the majority of them are tender-age, coming through the southwest border, smuggled on behalf of either a parent or someone else to get them up to the United States. When an unaccompanied alien child, UACs, is I'll explain how the whole process goes, and then I'll explain what our charter was. So a child comes up to the border, and they could either get apprehended by the Border Patrol, not even apprehended, they just walk up to them with whoever's in charge of the group, or they can go through the port of entry, which would be an officer, a CBP officer, Customs and Border Protection officer. They're taken into custody. They're handed over to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, who processes them. And then they're handed over to Health and Human Services, which is HHS, who then hands them over to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is part of HHS's contracted facilities, civilians who have a contract with the government to take charge of these little kids. And then those kids are released to a sponsor. Now, our charter was to find out who these smuggling organizations were and how we could disrupt and dismantle them and stop this flow of children coming up from the southwest border. Now, yes, there were MS-13 teenagers integrated within. We know that. But there was a massive...
And MS-13 is the gang down in Mexico.
Yep. Mara Salvatore, yeah. Yep. And they're really, really, really bad people. And so I was assigned to this human smuggling cell. There wasn't a lot of us there. I was one of the sole representatives for the agency I worked for. And I found out that, you know, this is 2015, year before an election cycle, that these kids, these UACs, were getting released to sponsors. And these sponsors weren't all legitimate. And out of a sample of 29,000, 3,400 of these sponsors had criminal records, up into including sex offenses. So I said, hey, you know what? That's not right. You know, at this time, there was 84,000 kids coming, 84,000 plus a year coming through. I had a spreadsheet. That spreadsheet said, out of these 29,000 people we ran checks on, 3,400 were criminals. I said, okay, how come we're not vetting these sponsors? And because there were so many kids, they weren't vetting the sponsors like they were mandated. They were supposed to do fingerprints. They're supposed to run criminal histories. They were basically just handing the kids off to anybody and anybody that was coming in. That's the way I saw it. And this spreadsheet I found was a month old. So I said, hey, you know what? We're the human smuggling cell. I've done dynamic operations in my life. I've done, at this point, I've done a lot. You know, I'm 16 years into my career after a tour in Iraq, and it fell on deaf ears. So I said, well, you know, the spreadsheet's a month old. What about these little kids? And I had access to it, what they call the Health and Human Services Unaccompanied Alien Children database. And when I looked at that, I could see the pictures of these kids. And I'm looking at a sampling of them. And there's like little babies, little 2-3-year-old kids that are getting released to criminals. You know, at the time, my kids were, I think, 6 and 8. And I said, well, if we're not going to do anything, then I went home and I did some Google research. I found out how to legally blow the whistle. And I always say legally blow the whistle, because there's people who out there leak stuff and go to the media and everything. But I didn't. I went right to the Office of Special Counsel and I blew the whistle.
It would just seem common sense that you wouldn't release babies and small kids to a criminal, right?
Yeah.
But yeah. So, okay. So out of that came a book. Is that what the evolution of that experience?
Well, later on, there was a lot of stuff going on in the background. I was fighting with Health and Human Services, telling them that they need to get the sheet, they need to vet it, and they need to do the right thing and start fingerprinting these sponsors, start doing the right everything. And I'm going back and forth with Health and Human Services, with my Office of Special Counsel, a lawyer. And I eventually, get debriefed by them, allegedly confidential. But it turns out it was a kind of almost like a witch hunt. They found out my identity through that meeting I had with them, a telephonic meeting. And the very next day I went back to work at that human smuggling cell. I was terminated from my detail. At that point, I went to Senator Charles Grassley and really blew the whistle and whistleblower retaliation and everything. That ends up putting a target on my back, and I eventually have to leave the agency. That is where, you know, a couple years ago, you started seeing pictures of kids in cages, kids at the border. Well, that was from the time frame that I blew the whistle, and that's why those pictures came out. Hence, I wrote the book to kind of say, this is me, this is what I did, and this is my backstory, and this is who I am, and this is what the reality of the border is.
It's incredible, incredible story. You've got a great podcast. I've been on it. Thank you. Tell me more about the theme and what you're trying to accomplish.
I love podcasting. This is my I've been on major news networks and everything else you could possibly imagine, talking about the border and talking about everything, talking about what we just talked about. But my podcast is based on the protectors. These are the ones that run towards danger. They could be law enforcement. They could be military. They could be veterans who have run towards danger. And especially, you know, I like to say that I talk to emergency responders, i.e. fire people and ambulance, EMTs, everybody. And I always say, and those that support them. Because so many of us get behind our veteran community and everything else. Why not document who they are as well? So what I do is I always say zero politics. So I do a 30-minute show. I do video. I just have a good chat with good people and find out what their stories are and how I could help them, how I could promote them. And we're now on Amazon Fire TV, Roku, YouTube, and every major podcast platform.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, keep spreading it. You're doing good work out there. And, you know, this conversation has been fascinating. I've literally had, you know, rock stars, all kinds of athletes. I've had military people on, but you kind of represent a whole different category of the people I've at least talked to. And it's really been fascinating to hear your story, the intrigue. I mean, there's no question that every day, I'm sure, is a different day for you. It's not business as usual. You're not pushing a pen, you know, in some office. You're out there doing real tactical stuff. And there must have been some job satisfaction at some level for you as you've, you know, spent these last 20 years doing this really a variety of different things.
It's definitely been interesting. And now my greatest thing is just raising kids. I love it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So you've got a pretty cool website, jasonpicklow.com. Is that correct?
jasonpicklow.us. jasonpicklow.com is taken by someone. I don't know.
Well, let's get rid of that person. And no, so it's jasonpiccolo.us is where you can find Jason. He's got so many podcasts you can tap into. You can listen to the past. You can see what's going on in the future. His books, all those things, there's links there. So for sure, check him out if you want to dig down and get some intrigue into your life. So Jason, thank you so much today for coming on the show to really help educate more about what's been going on the borders and the good work that you've been doing over the last 20 to make our country a better place.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.